This is Phil Ferrin, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 205, and I'm back in my car driving again. The car is a little cool. It hasn't warmed up yet. So if you hear me kind of shivering a little bit, it's because it's a little chilly. I am ready for spring. Anyways, last week was weird, sitting at home at my desk. Never could really feel like I was getting in stride. I think I need the extra distraction of driving to kind of make this better. It's kind of weird. My buddy and I have agreed on a topic for the 4-year anniversary of the podcast, which will be coming up at episode 208, which means that's only a few weeks away. I think I had mentioned that my buddy who was going to do the 3-year with me and then he couldn't, I had asked him, but he's in the middle of school and he's got a bunch of projects and all that kind of stuff. And he said, you might want to try to get somebody else. So I quickly located another friend, and I think this friend may be, in time, the only guy who has ever listened to every single podcast. So that's worth celebrating. Anyways, last week, in a pitiful way, I did talk about one of the latest studies that had come out and about the irrational consumer, but I was specifically interested in that. News of the week. Still writing, going along well, got my 6,000 words in last week. Actually, did 2,500 words on Friday of last week. And I was thinking, wow. You know, and it took me, I don't know, 4 hours, 4 or 5 hours-ish, but I got in 2,500 words, and I was thinking, hey, you know, if I could do that consistently, and I was doing this full-time, I could actually write one of these books the size of Amanda and the Sleaberry Tree in 20 days, so that would be like 5 weeks. That would be... And if I was writing that much, you know, I would probably only write 5 days a week. Well, I don't know. When you're away from it for a little bit, then it gets harder. So maybe I'd write 6 days a week. You know, target 2,500 words a day. You know, that would give me 15,000 a week. And these books are only like 50,000 words. I could theoretically get one done in 3 or 4 weeks, which is pretty interesting. But obviously, I'm not going to be writing full-time anytime soon. So that still means, though, at 6,000 words, if the Realmers series ends up being somewhere around 75,000 words a book. At 6,000 words, that's still 10 weeks. I mean, that's like 3 months. And I can knock one of those out, which is be good, because now all of a sudden, it's not 12 years it would take me to get that series written of 24 books. It's more like 6 years. So, you know, it's going along good. Just today, I was, you know, working along, and then in the back of my brain, things are kind of still percolating. Every once in a while, they pop up, and I may have finally figured out the ending that I'm going to use, and I think I'm going to be able to use the title, Amanda and the Hare-Footed Flare, even though it's not going to show up until the very end of the book. And I have to decide if that's okay. I think that's okay. I think it is, because the whole book is sort of setting up for why that comes about. So I think it's going to be okay. It's fine. But anyways, I am on page 175 or so, and I'm only going to go to about 250 pages on this book. So this week already I've gotten 2,500 words in, and I really expect to do in excess of 1,500 words tomorrow, unless I have to go into work for some reason. So 1,500 to 2,000 words on Friday, and then on Saturday again, and I'll be at my 6,000 words again. So yeah, that's working out just fine. All the rest of the world is good. Everything's puttering along. Two this past week. I was trying to think two dinners with friends. Had a couple of friends that were otherwise occupied, so we didn't get together. But it's been good. It's been very, very good. One of my buddies just had a new baby, as in a couple of weeks ago, and so we chatted about that this week for a little bit. And he's new father. This is his first baby, so it's fun to kind of relive some of those things through that. Anyways, okay, back to last week we were talking about the irrational consumer, and specifically I was honing in on this because they said in this article that it's not realistic anymore, from what we know of neurology, to speak of the brain, that we really need to refer to that in plural, that there is the frontal cortex that handles the logical, reasonable, rational decisions, and then there's the limbic system that is much more visceral, much more emotional, much more pleasure-oriented. And then we supposedly have this switchboard that decides whether or not the decision is going to be routed to the frontal cortex or whether it's going to be routed to the limbic system. And that really begins to sound very, very much like flesh and spirit and will. So anyways, I did mention last week that I was finishing up on a book by Claudia Christian, who, for those of you who don't recognize that name, has been an actress for many, many years, decades and decades. One of her more famous roles was as Commander Susan Ivanova from Babylon 5. So if you're a sci-fi fan, you'll remember that. And if you're not, you won't. But she has been on other shows, even recently, including like Nip Tuck, whatever the name of the show was. And she was just on an episode of Grimm. She's done a lot of voiceover work. And she's, you know, been in several other shows as well. So anyways, I think her first show, she was on Dallas for one of the episodes when she was just young, 16-ish, sometime in there, 16, 17, and has had quite a bit of success, has been successful. So anyways, her book is called Babylon Confidential. I'm just turning off the ringer on my phone. It's called Babylon Confidential, A Memoir of Love, Sex, and Addiction. And it's pretty interesting. And specifically when I started really getting interested in the book was when she began to talk about her addiction and talk about it in a very specific manner. Even last week, when I was talking about the limbic system versus the frontal cortex, you come away from that division, from those elements, with the feeling that the frontal cortex is logical, reasonable, intellectual, and that the limbic system is just this grunting, me want pleasure thing inside us. And yet that's not really, if you've listened to any of these podcasts for long enough, you'll understand I don't really think of the flesh in that term, in those terms. I think of the flesh as a planning, scheming, intelligent, persistent force for destruction within our lives that is with us our entire lives, and if you give it any slack, it will take more from you and continue to take more from you. And as I was reading Susan Ivanova, Claudia Christian's biography, I found a lot of these ideas resonating within what she was writing. And it's interesting because I think that a lot of people, before they come to that realization, have got to get down to the point where the flesh has enough control over their lives that they begin to feel the oppressiveness and the dedication that the flesh has to their destruction. I'm going to turn on some heat here because we should be warmed up by now. But it does take coming to this point of desperation before you start realizing that you're contending with something that is persistent and focused and really only has one goal. And it was very interesting to read through her reflections on the experience because alcoholism almost destroyed her life. It was very close to destroying her life. So it was really interesting to read through her, the way she imaged this, the way she described it. And she picks up her story and then, you know, tells flashbacks as to how she got there. She picks up her story when at one point she is leaving the house at 4 a.m. because she has to have a drink, even though she knows the convenience store can't start selling alcohol till 6. And she's going out in the dead of night because she's just desperate. And she said at one point in her career in the 80s, she starred in a movie called The Hidden, which has become a cult classic of sci-fi movie. And she said in that her character was possessed by an alien who steals human bodies to disguise its presence. She said that was the state I'd reached with my drinking. It was as if another person had taken me over and all I could do was look on like a bystander at a traffic accident. And she talks about going into these stores first thing early in the morning and sometimes ordering things that could be used as ingredients for cooking and saying, oh, well, I'm making a souffle. How the first time that a young, in her terms, some pimple-faced kid looked at her and said, a little early for this, isn't it? She said, I was just mortified. And she said, I'd get in my car and twist off the top of the beer and start drinking, and after only a few gulps, I was throwing up all over the parking lot. She said, I was out of control and more than a little frightened. Now, what's interesting is this addiction that had taken over her, she came to start calling it the monster within her. And it's really interesting because she begins in the book going through the different things that fed her monster. For instance, she was in a relationship with a guy, a Scottish actor, and never mind names, but in just listening to her recitals about this guy, it's obviously this guy is possessed of his flesh and is destroying himself and is going to destroy anything around him, but she falls in love with him, you know, and he just day after day after day wears her down with his criticisms and his emotional turmoil that he's generating. And she says what I've said about, you know, that the flesh in another person actually hates the flesh in me, and so it's going to do whatever it can to stir that up. And that flesh hates me as well. And so what it's going to try to do is it knows if it can get my flesh stirred up, then there's a higher propensity for me to be on the road to destruction. And so it's happy to do that because it hates everybody and everything. And it pursues a scorched earth policy. It is just trying to destroy. And she said, in reflecting on this relationship, and she had a bunch of these kind of relationships, but this was one of the worst ones. In reflecting on that, she said his own inner monster had spoken to the darkness in me, and now that darkness sought to rear up and displace my previously confident inner voice, the voice that had always served as my guide. Because while she had had some traumatic experiences early in her life, she said, I had always had this voice, the voice of the angel, the voice of the protector within her, that would say, oh, that's okay, you're going to be okay, you know, you're doing great, that kind of thing. And she said she had gotten to the place with the drinking and with the weight that it was putting on and what it was doing to her body, that she said, look, she said, as a working actress, you can't help but have body issues. She said, it's not as bad as for models, but this is the way we make our living. And she had tried out for, or she was a guest lead in a TV show. It was called She Spies. And the wardrobe person was having trouble fitting her because she was a bit bloated from all the alcohol and that sort of thing. And afterwards, she said, I thought I did, you know, okay, she said, but afterwards she got word through her agent that the casting director said that he would never hire her again because she was chunky. And she said, you know, in this business, she said, you're a product, you're a storefront mannequin. She said, ordinarily, she said, I would have been fine with that. Oh, sorry, it wasn't only the drinking. It was because, oh, rats. It was because she had just miscarried as well. And so she was carrying some pregnancy weight. And so in the midst of all that, she said, you know, the monster's down there whispering to her. And this is, to me, this is where it starts getting interesting. It's like, yeah, this voice really is in you, and it knows exactly what to say to get the maximum amount of impact on you. And she says, it's sitting out there saying, you're fat, you're disgusting, your career's over. And she said, the monster within her knew that she was vulnerable at those points. And she said, it was key to make hay while the sun shone. In other words, it was plotting. It was looking. It saw that she was vulnerable. And, you know, this is what I've been saying for a decade, that if we're, well, more than a decade now, that if we'll just pay attention, we'll realize that the flesh within us is more than just me want sex, me want food, you know, me want that shiny pretty thing. It's more than that. It's not just a collection of desires. There's actually a scheme involved, and it's looking for just the right things to say. And so, and she starts rehearsing some of these things that this voice in her head is saying. See, I told you you're fat. Your career is going down the gurgler. You better go on a starvation diet or something. Now, that's going to be tough. So get a good stiff drink. Because that's all it's trying to drive her to. It's trying to drive her to drink because it knows that that's going to be the best vehicle to destroy her. And she said the further she got into drinking and alcoholism, the quieter the voice of her angel got. And once that voice started disappearing, she said, once our confidence, once our belief in ourselves is sufficiently silenced, the monster's voice is all that's left, and it masquerades as our true self and leads us to believe its running commentary is true insight. And that is absolutely true. That's exactly what it does. The flesh within us mimics, in fact, God's voice sometimes, and condemns us and pretends that it's God that is condemning us, because it knows that puts us faster on the road to destruction. And it's really interesting, because she claims that this was the monster too, that But I don't know. At one point when she's struggling with all this, her dog, like, goes crazy and mauls her face. And she gets some plastic surgery done, but she said, then the flesh starts in on that. You know that you're deformed. The voice spoke to my own deepest fears, but it seemed to make a lot of sense. But don't worry, there are roles for people like you. You can put on prosthetics and play aliens for the rest of your life. She said, the voice was right, my career was over. See, it's picking up on all these things. It's not just a collection of me want sex, me want food. It's picking up on exactly what's going on and where she's most vulnerable in these situations. And when even the plastic surgeon did a great job and he put her face back together and everything was great, she said that she had a little bit of hope at that point. And she makes the statement, it only takes a little light to drive away a lot of darkness. And once I gained some perspective, I rushed back to dry land in a survivable style. So she seems to be on the mend here. She realizes, hold it, everything's not over, things are going to be okay. But then I thought, yep, when I read this, she said, what I hadn't realized was that the monster was in it for the long haul. She hadn't disappeared, only retreated as a tactical gambit. She had given up the battle with the idea of winning the war. And this is really important to understand about the flesh. The flesh is constantly planning, and it's very patient. And if you put your foot down and say, I'm not listening to you, and you start getting disciplined, it'll just fall back and say, oh, you're doing such a great job. You're doing such a great job. But you know, it'd be fun if you just did. But you're doing such a great job. And then it just starts whispering again. And just seeing what it can do to get you off track again. Because it really has to back down. We had snow, so there's a lot of ice and things I'm driving over to get through the tracks to get to my mail. One moment, let me get to my mail, and then hopefully I will be able to back my car up. All right. That's there. And she said, and even after things were getting better, she said, the monster just sat and she watched and she waited for another dark wave. Because she said her monster knew that with her lifestyle, the way she was living, that sooner or later there was going to be some big emotional hit that was going to come. And when that happened, it was going to be ready. And she decides to get herself a house, and then in the midst of getting this house, she's got this basement that needs some work. She said, then the monster just starts whispers to say, you know, you really need a big wine cellar. I'm backing into my garage. You need a big wine cellar. I mean, just think of the parties you could throw and how much fun it's going to be. So she goes ahead. The money's coming in at that point in her career. And so she goes ahead and she builds this huge wine cellar. Even though, well, maybe she's not really willing to admit it to herself at this point, but even though she has a problem with alcoholism, she builds a wine cellar. She said, my monster was saying, you deserve it. You've worked hard to get where you are. You deserve to celebrate in style. And for that, you'll need to fuel those amazing parties that you're throwing. About the same time, she has a friend who calls her up and says, hey, you know, the wines from France are great this year. This is in 2000. The wines from France are great, the new wines. What you need to do is you need to stock up on these things. You know, hold on to them, I guess 10 years or something, and then you'll have a choice. You can either just drink them because, you know, that would be great, or you could turn around and sell them and make some money. So she decides, okay. So she drops $14,000 on I think it's 100 bottles of wine. And she had her wine cellar, so she put them down there. And okay, great. She said, by then I'd already completed construction on my ultimate wine cellar, a shrine to Bacchus, where I could afford my drinking the status it deserved. Somewhere in the darkness, my monster was smiling and sharpening her claws. So then she starts falling on hard times, and she's drinking more and more. And she says, she gets to the place where all she has left is her house and this wine collection. She doesn't want to sell her house, so she calls her friend and she says, hey, I have to sell these wines. He gives her some names. She calls them. They all lowball her on the price because they know she's desperate. And she gets really ticked off. And she said, in the middle of that, the monster says, you know what would really teach those blankety blanks a lesson? If you drank every single one of those blankety blank bottles. And she does. Not immediately. But that thought keeps playing over and over. She said later on when she, you know, was really, really getting desperate, the monster's talking to her. So what? So you're just going to sit here and suffer a slow and painful demise? Death by a thousand cuts? That's not the Claudia I know. Show those blankety blanks. You teach them a lesson. So she thought, yeah, I am. And so she's got, I guess it's 180 bottles. of French wine, and she like drinks through them over the course of the year. Just drinks them all. And then, you know, her mom is trying to work with her, and her mom's trying to help her out, and her mom's starting to get upset with her because she's drinking so much. And, you know, then the monster says, oh, you know, you're very touchy of late, and your mom's getting suspicious. You need to ramp things up to make sure she helps us. And so she actually tells her mom that she had a bad pap smear, and there might be trouble. When she did, because when you start listening to the flesh, it's going to get you to do all sorts of destructive things. So, but, you know, she ends up with some jobs and she ends up kind of getting better. And, you know, she hasn't drunk anything for like 4 months. And, you know, it waits, the monster waits, and then it starts whispering again. You know, you haven't touched a drop in 4 months. You're not an alcoholic, not even close. And this is the opportunity for you to prove to yourself you're not addicted. Just have a small quantities of the best stuff. Trust me, it'll be okay. And of course, you know, she goes way overboard and, you know, it's blackout. It's a blackout drunk. She said, the monster was gathering power, and I was getting a little frightened. She said it was something like out of a Stephen King novel, the kind where you have an evil twin personality who takes over and does all kinds of stuff without your knowing. She'd kind of cleaned herself up by her 40th birthday. She said at that point, she'd been sober for almost 6 months. She said, I was sober as a judge and just about as boring. And it was 40, and she was in London. The monster says, Claudia, this is your chance to have a real party. You made it to middle age. You survived. You deserve to celebrate. Go have a good time. And she said, that's one of the things that she hates. She uses more colorful language that she hates about the monster. And this is absolutely true. She said, I lasted it out. I buckled up and I had written the blankety blank bull for a half a year. And then one slip and I was back to square one. She said it was beyond frustrating. It's a disease that swallows hope. She just keeps going, and it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse and worse. She tries rehab. She tries this. She tries that. She tries the other. She eventually discovers something called the Sinclair Method, which becomes the second really interesting part of this book. And that is, with the Sinclair Method, and frankly, some of the friends that I've talked to about this week, they get a little uncomfortable. But this is really interesting. In the Sinclair Method, you basically go to a doctor and you get a prescription for a fairly cheap pill. It's like $2 a pill, generic. You can get generic pills. And what it does is it suppresses the dopamine response in your brain. And you take this pill 1 hour before you drink. And then, you know, you have your one glass of wine or something. And it suppresses that pleasure response that you get from it. And over time, you begin to unlearn, because one of the things she had done was she had trained her brain to have a heightened pleasure response to alcohol. And people do this with all kinds of stuff. I was talking to the young couple that I get together with on Saturdays, and the wife was saying that she had seen a study where they put people in MRIs and watched the response in the brains of obese people versus anorexic people versus control group, and that the obese people had a much higher level of pleasure response when they were eating food than the other two groups did, that the obese people had actually trained themselves for their pleasure centers to react greater when they ate. And so then when they weren't eating, when they were trying to cut back, when it was just a craving. And that's what had happened to Claudia Christian as well. And I take away from this really kind of two things. The first thing is, I would hope nobody has to figure out that the flesh is fully dedicated to destruction in the way that Claudia Christian figured it out, because she had to get really very low and very deep in destruction before she recognized the flesh for what it was. I would hope that people could pick up the smaller signs and say, yeah, that is the voice of the flesh within me. And yeah, I may not see all the paths that it's trying to take me down to destruction, but if I listen to that voice, I'm one step further, and I'd just as soon not take that step. So it was really interesting to see someone reflecting all these things, because she had gotten down low enough that she could really see the flesh for what it was. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I've said over and over that I don't know if this idea of flesh in spirit is really, really, really how it works in the brain. I don't know that. I know it's an extremely useful framework. So I don't know how all the neurons fire in the brain and what causes these seeming two competing forces to come to the fore. But I do know it's an analogy that works. And maybe the one thing that reading this book has given me is also the idea that just separating it between the frontal cortex and the limbic system is not sufficient. Because as Claudia Christian reflects, and as I have reflected, there definitely seems to be a consciousness at work with the flesh. And I would say it's our own consciousness. It has available to it all of our intelligence, all of our scheming. I mean, when it's telling you, whoa, 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 she's, you know, your mom's getting to the place where you can't do that. You know, you need to pull something out that's going to keep her on your side. I mean, that's scheming. That's understanding her mom's emotional state and what she could say to make that happen. And she mentions in the book in other places how that the monster's very clever and it always had a comeback. It always knew just what to say to try to avert suspicion from the fact that she was drinking as much as she did. So I don't know exactly what the mechanisms are, but I think it's more than just frontal cortex and limbic system. There's things that are interwoven within us. It is true that we are two internally, but it is also true that it's all part of us. It's all part of this war. And the other thing that came out of just the physicality of this fight that we have with the flesh that I came away from this book was just the idea of don't screw up your reward system. Don't do that. Because that will put you in a very difficult place to get out of. If you consistently train your reward system in some path of destruction, be it from overeating or overdrinking or over sexing, or, you know, whatever, over angering or over envying or over grousing or greed or any of those things, you know, if you let the flesh reward you for any of those things and you keep pursuing that reward, you will train yourself into a place where if you don't have those things, it will not only be a physical reaction of deprivation, but you are going to be having a brain chemical mental reaction to the deprivation. And once you get yourself to that point, it's going to be really, really hard to get back from it. And you can expect that you're going to have to take a lot of steps to get back from it. It is possible to do. It is a function of your will. But I think just like Claudia Christian said towards the end of her book, you know, it's something that now she will battle the rest of her life. And any time she has alcohol, she has to implement this discipline in her life of taking this pill that suppresses her dopamine response for when she drinks. And it kind of made me wonder if there couldn't be something there to translate that to other addictions that people struggle with, be it overeating or being sex or, you know, whatever. It's really fascinating. Very, very interesting. Anyways, this is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.